This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the saga of a Nigerian-American mother whose American dream was turned into a nightmare by a policeman's bullet. A new book reveals U.S. efforts to overthrow governments in Latin America during the Bush and Obama administrations. And a new film on the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. It's called Fear No Gumbo.
But first, a researcher at the University of Connecticut has come up with a price tag for reparations for Black people for slavery in the United States. Professor Thomas Kramer puts the cost at between $5.9 trillion and $14.2 trillion, depending on how you do the calculations.
Basically, what I did is I just added up the man, woman, and child hours that were available during slavery while it existed in the United States and multiplied that with the then common wage for unskilled labor. So it's a conservative estimate because it's based on the wage for unskilled labor, yet many slaves actually were skilled. So it's a low-bound estimate.
Yes, it certainly is. In fact, many slaves were what some people call rent-a-slaves. 90% of the railroad workers in the South were slaves, and a similar number in terms of the sailors.
The buildings in Washington, D.C., including, I think, the Congress, and I think the White House as well, I'm not sure, were slaves as well.
One study showed that in the year 1850, the value of slaves surpassed every other American economic asset other than the land itself. But that would certainly be an underestimate, since much of the land in the slave states only had value because there were slaves working on it producing cash crops.
That's exactly right. And I would even go further and say that because there are existing estimates of reparations that are based on the price of slaves, with the idea in mind that the prices were the return that slave owners expected to have from slaves, so they represent the value that the slave had to the slave owner, and based on that, they calculated reparations values. I think what those methods miss is the fact that slaves not only produced for cash crop production, which would be reflected in that price of the slave, but they produced a lot for domestic consumption, both by the slaves and by the slave owners. They produced the clothing that the slave owners and often the slave masters wore. They produced the food, the hotel services, so to speak. I mean, George Washington ran a vast operation on his plantation where visitors were generously served with food and accommodations, yet he always complained of having little money, being strapped for cash. And that was very common. So slave owners actually lived in opulence, but were actually cash poor because they directly lived off the labor that the slaves produced on the plantation itself for the consumption of the plantation itself.
Yes, in fact, in some cases, slaves were used as capital, treated as a capital good, and sometimes as a currency in terms of trade.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Most folks accept the notion that it was the surplus value that was generated by this slave labor that allowed the United States to burst upon the world scene as a huge economic power, this second great industrial revolution power, and thus slaves as providing the seed capital for what later became an economic empire were even more valuable than their price at the time would imply, or the value of wages at the time would imply.
Right, that's absolutely true. I do believe that in a way, basically, the original sin of the United States is that the original Constitution basically gave claim to the slaves' labor to two parties. So it was one property with two owners, once the slaves themselves, by the virtue of the fact that the Constitution talked of them as persons, and later in the Fifth Amendment says no property shall be taken from any person unless with just compensation. And at the time, it gave the rights over the slave to the slave masters, and this was all clouded in language. I mean, they never used the term slave. It was persons held to labor and persons to whom such labor may be due. In any event, the government basically gave ownership over the slave's time to both parties, so to speak. And in a way, you could look at this as a loan that the United States took out, you know, a startup loan that the United States took out with African Americans and never repaid.
That would put a different kind of meaning to Dr. Martin Luther King's early saying that we have a check that needs to be cashed.
Right, exactly, exactly. And in my article, I guess what I'm trying to point out is that legally and politically, this case of multi-generational reparations policy is not necessarily new, that there was a precedent in the so-called spoliations claims, whereby the United States paid basically reparations to ship owners or their heirs after 123 years. I don't know if you've heard about the spoliations claims before. This was a case where the French government basically hijacked American ships in the open sea when the two countries were nearly at war in the 1790s. Because the United States had reneged on its agreement to support France if her possessions in the Caribbean were to be threatened, and they were by the Haitian Revolution. Then the first original ship owners and later their heirs basically demanded reparations from the French government for the property that was taken. And when the United States negotiated a deal with France, it forgave those reparations. And the ship owner said, well, government, you can't do that. You can't take our property and use it for public use without just compensation, according to the Fifth Amendment. And so they demanded reparations from the American government. And that worked its way through the entire 1800s until, in 1910, the spoliation claims were finally paid out and the case was resolved. So I thought that was an interesting case because it took many generations, and the government actually went in and researched who owned the claims, and they sent people to France to do archival research. And politically, but in the paper I'm describing how the French spoliations claims were negotiated, it was a very difficult political process, but it succeeded.
Clearly, that was a case of political will. But for the whole first half of the 1800s, the United States debated whether slaveholders should be compensated for the emancipation of their slaves. And this was supported to varying degrees by U.S. presidents from Monroe to Abraham Lincoln in his early years as president.
Right. For most abolitionists, initially, it was only conceivable with reparations to the slave owners. And I think it's the fact that secession happened and the Civil War happened that discussion was basically done with. But the debt to African Americans was never made a topic and never explored.
Now, the figure that you've come up with based upon wages during the slave period for unskilled labor is between $5.9 trillion and $14.2 trillion. Why the wide gap there, the wide range?
Well, I calculated two different scenarios. Both are conservative. Both are at an interest rate of only 3%. And if you only change the interest rate slightly, the numbers blow up in your face exponentially. So I took a 3% interest rate, which would be very conservative. And I guess which, you know, more realistic would be 5-6% interest rate, but that would blow the numbers up enormously. And so that's the first conservative calculation I made. And the other one for the first estimate of $5.9 trillion, I took a scenario where I only used a daytime work hour, so about 12 hours a day, and only for slaves above the age of, I think it was 5 years old. basically slaves of working age with the numbers of hours that were actually worked on average. The 14.2 trillion estimate is a little more generous in the fact that it counts sleeping hours as well, but with the reasonable, in my mind, reasonable argument that slaves were on call 24 hours a day. And sleep was not an activity, you know, recreational activity for the benefit of the slave, but it was basically to regenerate the working power. So it belonged, the sleep belonged to the slave owner, as did the food. There are estimates, slave reparations estimates, that go through complicated computations to subtract out the food and the clothing that slaves consumed. But in a way, they were not the property of the slave. In that system, they were the property of the owner. So that's why I get a higher estimate here, basically with the doubling of the work hours available.
I read recently that the production of cotton per slave between the years 1820 and 1860 multiplied three times without the benefit of any technological developments. In other words, it was entirely speed up with slaves just working harder, but producing three times as much cotton. Where might that fit in your calculations?
Well, I mean, that would fit right into the range that slaves were worked outside of the 12 hours that are usually assumed, that slave owners tried everything to extract more labor from slaves. And they were not legally required to consider the slave's health or anything. So slaves could theoretically be worked to death. And that was actually the case in the French colony of Saint-Domingue, where new slaves would be imported to replace old slaves. So slaves are simply worked to death. That was cheaper in the United States because slave importation was banned after 1808. You had to be a little more considerate and therefore work them to exhaustion, but not quite to death.
Now, with these figures, this range of reparations from between $5.9 trillion to $14.2 trillion, have you worked out how much that would represent for the 40 million living African-American slave descendants?
Basically, I calculated how much everybody would owe if this was paid from taxes, and how much each African-American alive today would receive. And since African-American have a dual role as debtors, meaning as Americans, as well as its claimants, as slave descendants, the net per capita reparations would amount to $140,000 in scenario one. That's the more conservative scenario with only 12 hours of working per day. And $336,258 in the scenario that takes all 24 hours per day as billable hours.
And of course, in your article, you did not propose how this money should be distributed or whether it should even be distributed in the form of money. But this is an exercise so that people can get their minds around the value of labor in some hard numbers terms.
Right. I mean, whether my amount is probably too conservative, so actual demands could be higher. On the other hand, in the past reparations cases that I cite, only a certain percentage of the debt was ever paid. I don't remember exactly, so don't quote me on that, but I think it was maybe 10% or 13% of the original debt was paid out in the end. It was still a handsome sum. But what form reparations will ultimately take and how much is paid and what's considered and what's not considered, that would be up to the political process to decide. For me, this was simply an exercise to show that it can be calculated. The numbers are readily there to come up with reasonable estimates. And the methods, you can debate about the methods and tweak them and stuff, but it's not that this is entirely unknowable.
But it is entirely unthinkable to vast majorities of white Americans.
Well, it's a threatening thought, but I think if you talk about these estimates, like from $140,000 to $336,000, those in house values, it's basically the value of a house, that fits nicely with what the wealth gap is between African Americans and whites. In 2009, it was estimated to be, by the Pew Research Center, it was estimated to be $107,472, the wealth gap. So in kind of in the order of magnitude, the slave debt would fit nicely with an amount that would eradicate the persisting wealth gap between African Americans and whites. And I think translated in those numbers, in the equivalent of a house or something like that, it's more digestible.
Yes, there is a kind of scale that people can see when you put it that way. Of course, right. That would not take into account the debt for discrimination and all manner of racist policies that have suppressed black wealth since emancipation.
That's absolutely true. This exercise I did is extremely limited. That's another conservative assumption that I've made, that I've only looked at slavery while it existed in the United States. So it ignores colonial slavery, which a vast amount would be due, but probably from Great Britain. And then Jim Crow discrimination and job discrimination and whatnot after the abolition of slavery.
That was Professor Thomas Kramer at the University of Connecticut.
Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo is an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report, a renowned whistleblower and an activist with the Hands Up Coalition, D.C. She's also become a close friend and comrade with the mother of Emmanuel Okutuga, a Nigerian-American college senior who was shot dead by a cop in suburban Washington in 2011. Dr. Coleman Adebayo says her Nigerian friend's American dream has turned into a nightmare.
I've lived in Africa, feels like the majority of my life, on and off, throughout my young adulthood and now. And what has always struck me about being in Africa and being a part of an African family is how powerful American propaganda has been in Africa. There are very few critical voices in Africa that would contradict what people on the continent hear almost on a daily basis from Voice of America and other kinds of American propaganda instruments. And so you have a situation in which, to a large extent, most Africans accept the American narrative about African Americans. Everything from the fact that we're lazy to the fact that we're violent to we're no account. I mean, all the stereotypes that white people have of African Americans, to a large extent, you can also hear those kinds of stereotypes being repeated in Africa as well as in African communities in the United States. And so what was particularly interesting to me was when we started the demonstrations in front of the Department of Justice, the Justice Monday demonstrations, is that a number of black people from outside the United States who had sort of followed this American dream started coming to our demonstrations and started telling us stories about how their children were being killed by police. And one such person was the woman that we started calling Mama Emmanuel. And she came to our meeting. Her name is Olubumi Comfort Oludupe. And she started coming to our demonstrations, and she started telling us about her son Emmanuel. And at first, you know, it sounded very much like a typical story, but there was just something a little different about it, because she had come to this country voluntarily, whereas the majority of mothers, like myself, our families had been kidnapped. But here was a black woman, like so many others, who had actually followed the American dream and actually come to the United States because of this impression that the United States was going to hold for them the same kinds of opportunities that it would hold for European immigrants. So that was, I thought, an important distinction to make, and it was an important trail to follow for this story. Mama Emmanuel, who was an absolutely beautiful Nigerian woman, came to the country, and as promised, everything seemed to be falling in place. She was able to start a business. She's a vendor. Whether you're in New York or in Washington, D.C., you see the stands outside of the various buildings where people are selling, you know, chips and soft drinks and different things. Well, she didn't just have one of those. I think she had seven of those. And she had been able to locate these vending stands in the most important tourist areas of Washington, D.C., in front of the White House, in front of the Reagan Trade Building, in front of, the Department of Justice. So she really had a knack for sort of being in the right place at the right time. So she had really started making a lot of money. She was able to buy a plot of land in a very expensive area in the Washington, D.C. area, custom build a home, a 5-bedroom home on this land. She was able to educate all 5 children. Emmanuel would have been the last child, through very prestigious universities like Johns Hopkins University, University of Maryland, without her children taking a single dime in student loans. I mean, you know, she was really on track to be a success story, to epitomize the American dream. And then all of that fell apart. It all fell apart one morning. Emmanuel was supposed to meet his mother on February 19, 2011. And he had met his mother to help her out at one of her stands dozens of times before, and he was on his way to help her out. I think he only had 3 months before he graduated from Bowie State University. And so he was under pressure to finish his exams, but he knew, you know, that he had to help his mother out with the vending stand, and he was on his way to do that when he was stopped by a policeman named Christopher Jordan, who was a Montgomery County police officer. And according to this police officer, Emmanuel, just sort of for no good reason, decided to attack him with an ice pick as he walked down the street. According to Christopher Jordan's account, the policeman's account, Emmanuel tried to attack him with an ice pick, and in order to defend himself, he pulled his revolver and he shot Emmanuel 2 times, once in the forehead and once in the torso. And Emmanuel, from what I understand, died on the scene. Now, what's interesting about this account is that the police officer could not have possibly known that Emmanuel had just broken his right hand and couldn't hold anything in his right hand. It was still injured. And so to actually take out the ice pick that he used to help his mother chop up the ice for her stands out of his backpack and then to threaten this officer, he wouldn't have been able to put his hands in a position to actually hold the ice pick because the hand was still broken. Of course, Officer Jordan wouldn't have known that. But that was one of the facts of the case that never was revealed because the case never found its way into a courtroom. So from Sister Mom Emmanuel's side of the story, she's waiting for her son to arrive at the stand. He never shows up. And then that evening around 12 midnight, I believe, her daughter calls her mother and says, "Mom, Mom, he's dead. The police shot him." That was how she found out that her son Emmanuel had been murdered by Montgomery County police. And first, you know, obviously there was disbelief and just utter confusion, and they decide to go to the police station. When they went to the police station, the police identified and confirmed that it was her son, Emmanuel, who had been shot in Silver Spring, Maryland. But for some reason, the police decided not to leave his body in Montgomery County. They actually transported the body from Montgomery County to Baltimore, which is a different county altogether. This is, again, one of those mysterious pieces that we'll never know because there was never a trial. And when Mama Emmanuel tried to reach the people at the morgue in Baltimore because she wanted to see her son, they told her that he would not be available for viewing until Monday, and that she had to wait and see her son during regular business hours. So that's how she found out that her son had been murdered. And then, of course, we get the other complications of this case.
And how did it transpire that this didn't even go to trial?
Well, then it becomes even more, I think, in Alice in Wonderland, curious and curiouser. Because so now we've heard these stories that are just so inhuman that it's crazy. So Mommy Emanuel hires an attorney who finds out that the liquor store where her son Emanuel was shot to death did have a security camera, and his murder was actually captured on video. And so the attorney looked at it, reviewed the video, called Mama Emanuel, told her that the officer had said that there was an ice pick, but that he didn't see an ice pick in Emanuel's hand, and that it was actually the police officer who was the aggressor in the situation, that Emanuel, in fact, was trying to get away from the police officer when the police officer shot him two times. Mommy Emanuel, at that point, was trying to put together funeral arrangements because she's in shock. But not only that, when you talk to her, she says, look, you know, the coffin cost $4,000 or $5,000, the burial plot cost $10,000. So she was just literally bleeding money at this point. And not only that, but she had attorney's fees, filing fees. And so she was literally just being suffocated with financial costs around the death of her son. And so the lawyer had the video transferred to the Montgomery County Prosecutor's Office from the liquor store's possession. So during the grand jury hearing, it was brought to the attention of the judge that somehow the videotape had been erased, and therefore there was no videotape evidence of the murder of Emanuel. So the prosecutor's office filed a request to have the case dismissed. But the judge went a step further than just having the case dismissed. He actually ruled that the officer had actually performed his duty, and that, in fact, the officer was cleared because of justifiable homicide, that he had killed Emanuel in self-defense. And at that point, the case was closed.
In other words, he rendered a not guilty verdict without even the benefit of trial.
Exactly. So the question that I raise in my article, of course, is that before we had video evidence, didn't courts operate? Before we had video evidence, didn't trials take place? How is it that that one piece of evidence was so intrinsic to determining guilt or innocence that once it was no longer available, the only decision that the judge could make was that it was justifiable homicide? So they didn't question eyewitnesses. Remember, this happened in broad daylight on a very busy street. So there were eyewitnesses that could have been deposed. There was forensic evidence that could have been used. So all of this was basically dismissed, and the police officer's word was taken as gospel, and therefore the case against this officer was dismissed. And so at this point, Mommy Emanuel has been left with a murdered child. All of her money has been used to support the defense of her child, to bury her child. So she had to sell her custom-built five-bedroom home to be able to support these expenses. She is still trying to somehow keep peddling against the grain to support her children. So Mama Emanuel at some point finds herself homeless and living in the basement of a church. And that's when I met her, when she started coming to the Justice Monday events in front of the Department of Justice.
And she has since become a mainstay of the Hands Up Coalition DC.
No question about it. She's a part of the rock of the women's organizations that we're developing here in Washington, D.C. She's a mainstay with the Hands Up Coalition. She testified before the Presidential Commission when it came to Washington, D.C. She's gone to Annapolis. She's testified in Annapolis on police matters, even though she's doubtful that she will ever see justice in her own case. She is so committed to making sure that what happened to her never happens to another Black family. And so she is literally a tower of strength for everyone around her. And now she's somehow found her sea legs again. She's become active in her church. She's starting an anti-police crusade in her church, which is a Nigerian-based church. The article in Black Agenda Report is going to be spread throughout the Nigerian community so that they understand that the American dream is essentially a hoax. So she has really taken this to a very important place, and she's using her activism as a part of her healing process at this point because she knows she's making a difference in our community.
So after all these years as an immigrant to this country, she has experienced the reality of America as a Black person.
As she said to me, she now feels very African-American. She feels very much like, even though she didn't come to this country with the majority of us, when she talks about white supremacy, she now understands what she's talking about. When she talks about this long history of police brutality in the United States, she now has a story to share with other people. So in a very difficult way, this is sort of the Africanization of this particular Nigerian woman. And I think her story is so important from a Pan-African perspective, because what unites Black people in many ways is not only our culture and our ability to communicate to these incredible art forms we've developed throughout the ages, but also our fight against white supremacy. And Sis Comfort has now joined that fight. And I'm convinced that we can use these kinds of examples to make inroads into other African communities so that they begin to understand the reality of, quote unquote, the American dream, and begin to see that they have a lot more in common with African Americans than they thought they did before. These horrible murders became a part of the headlines of newspapers across the country.
Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo, speaking from Washington.
A new book reveals U.S. efforts to undermine and overthrow governments in Latin America during the Bush and early Obama administrations. The book is titled The WikiLeaks Files and is co-authored by Dan Beaton and two other researchers from the Center for Economic Policy and Research. The team examined diplomatic cables detailing U.S. subversions of the governments of Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, El Salvador, and Honduras. The United States claims that it is a good neighbor to nations in Latin America, but Dan Beaton says the evidence tells a very different story.
It's quite interesting, actually, to see, especially in light of recent events, notably last year's very violent protests and street blockades in Venezuela, which were aimed explicitly at ousting the elected president, Nicolas Maduro, that into the Obama administration, the WikiLeaks cables reveal that the U.S. has been funding protests and actually even has funded some violent student protest leaders. So we actually have the State Department talking about some of the violent history of some of these people, and yet, at least in one case, went on to not only support this individual, but actually gave him a State Department training. So this is something you're not going to see in the U.S. media coverage of what's happening in Venezuela and these other countries, but it's right there in the documents. And in the case of Bolivia, it's now known that the U.S. was actively and regularly engaging with the violent opposition in 2008. In 2008, there was a very serious effort at destabilizing the Bolivian government, again, the elected government, and it was led by not just groups of protesters in that case, but by elected officials, the governors of some of its richest states where very important natural gas deposits lie. And so there's a real racist and separatist movement at the time. These states were talking about seceding from Bolivia, forming their own state, and so on. There was a lot of very anti-indigenous racist rhetoric around all this. And these protests and other violent actions resulted in several deaths, at least 20 people, and serious property damage. And yet at the time, the U.S. didn't even allude to the gravity of the situation and vehemently denied that they were talking with these people. But now we know from the cables that that's exactly what was going on, and the U.S. government had been funding some of these states and these opposition leaders in the lead-up to this, and were in regular communication, even as they were talking about, if Evo Morales doesn't do this, we're going to, you know, we need to rely on blowing up gas lines and, you know, other more serious means of, you know, making sure he gets the message. I'm paraphrasing, but that's essentially what some of the cables say. And so these are real serious revelations of just how deeply the U.S. was involved in some of these destabilization efforts much more recently than had previously been recognized in the press.
Stirring up secessionist sentiments in Bolivia and financing some aspects of those is basically stirring up potential civil war, and in Bolivia, a race war. Is this legal or just bad diplomacy?
Some of this is questionable under international law, certainly at the least. It's obviously very bad diplomacy. And so this is actually why the Bolivian government expelled the U.S. ambassador at the time. A little bit of context and history here. The U.S. ambassador, Philip Goldberg, was caught on video going to a clandestine meeting with opposition leaders at the time. And when that came out, and also due to the amount of USAID money going into the country, which the U.S. would not disclose to whom all these USAID funds were going, the Bolivian government finally just said we had enough, expelled the U.S. ambassador, eventually expelled USAID as well, and so U.S.-Bolivian diplomatic relations have been broken off at the ambassadorial level ever since. And so it's very bad diplomacy, and the U.S. still has not owned up to what it's done and still has and is not disclosing to whom all the USAID funds have gone in Bolivia.
The Venezuelan government has long charged that the U.S. finances and instigates dissent in that country, but the U.S. corporate media, the New York Times, CNN, all of them, their attitude is that the Venezuelan government is simply using the U.S. as a scapegoat. But your look deep into the WikiLeaks file tends to indicate that the Venezuelans are not paranoid. They do have enemies in Washington.
No, that's right. We actually have a cable. This is from 2009, you know, which some of the journalists in the major media in the U.S. would say, you know, it's ancient history. Well, yeah, maybe this was happening in 2009, but what are they doing now? Well, come on. I mean, this is under the Obama administration. We have a sub-grantee of USAID at the time saying, and I quote, "The streets are hot," referring to growing protests against Chavez's efforts to consolidate power, and quote, "all these people organizing the protests are our grantees," unquote. That's a very clear indication that the U.S. has been funding protesters in Venezuela. Now, of course, the cables don't go up to last year, but why would we think that this kind of funding has stopped? I mean, there's no indication to think that you had years of U.S. support, very strong support for the opposition in Venezuela, including some extra-constitutional efforts to oust the elected government. Why would we think this has stopped? So this is really pertinent and necessary information for the major media to report when they're covering things like last year's protests against Nicolas Maduro, which, again, you know, the protest leaders like Leopoldo López and Maria Corina Machado were saying, you know, were explicitly, it was called La Salida, which means the exit. They wanted to see Nicolas Maduro exit the presidential office.
In light of this kind of evidence, which actually comes out of the U.S.'s own mouth, so to speak, it would not be unreasonable for these governments under attack to shut down these NGOs that are financed by the United States and subverting those governments. But of course, the U.S. corporate media would say that that would be an example of government repression.
Absolutely. And I mean, there have been efforts in Venezuela to stop U.S. funding for some of these organizations, but the Venezuelan government hasn't gone so far as to shut groups like Corina Machado's Sumate down outright. So this is the kind of thing that just would not be tolerated in the United States. I mean, can you imagine Chinese or Iranian funding of NGOs that are leading protests in Washington, D.C. with street blockades and the like, or maybe, you know, calling for a referendum, organizing a referendum to have Barack Obama possibly voted out of office, you know, which, of course, is a process that we don't have in this country. We don't have a recall possibility under our Constitution, but under the Bolivarian Constitution, which President Chavez and his movement brought into being, there is that possibility. And so Sumate, again, is an organization that we see throughout the cables going over years, is really a darling for the U.S. State Department. And even one cable, the U.S. ambassador at the time, explicitly linked to, quote, our interests, the United States interests. So we see this very close coordination between the U.S. and these NGOs, including funding, which just would not be tolerated in a similar kind of situation in the United States.
Yes, imagine if Black Lives Matter was the recipient of financing from the Venezuelan government openly in solidarity with the fight against racial discrimination. Imagine what the repercussions would be for Black Lives Matter here.
Absolutely. And I mean, the kind of demonization and red baiting that would happen, not to mention the level of FBI investigation and persecution. Of course, the FBI is investigating already, but I mean, that would actually give them a pretext. And I mean, who knows what would result, but clearly the ramifications would be very grave. These aren't peaceful protests. These are at times very disruptive, very violent protests. You know, there were 43 people killed in total in last year's protests in Venezuela. About half of those were a result of the protesters' actions. They would string barbed wire across intersections with the intention of decapitating Chavista motorcyclists. They would shoot people who would be stopped at the blockades that they had set up, as well as the Venezuelan National Guard and police being shot dead by some protesters. So this is a very violent movement we're talking about, which, again, we don't know whether or not it's funded by the U.S., but it's certainly worth pondering in light of these recent documents talking about U.S. funding for protests in Venezuela, whether some of these individuals and groups behind this have gotten some kind of U.S. support.
Now, again, this is the best kind of evidence because it's from the mouths or the pens of U.S. diplomats themselves. But how does the United States go about denying the import of these WikiLeaks?
Well, they really haven't had to do much denying because the U.S. press has basically ignored this. I mean, we've actually pointed out some of these very cables to journalists in some of the rare cases where they've looked at U.S. support for the NGOs and so-called civil society groups in Venezuela, and none of this ended up in the stories. There's a willful ignorance or willful, I would say, maybe even self-censorship of this information, and it's not the kind of thing that you regularly see reporters asking about in State Department or White House press briefings. So really, the U.S. government hasn't had to do much denial of what's in the WikiLeaks cables, at least on Latin America.
And again, in Bolivia, we have U.S. diplomats actively stirring up racial animosities in that country. And that's not absent in Venezuela either.
No, that's right. You know, in these countries like Bolivia and Venezuela, there's a lot of overlap between the class divide and racial divisions in society. And of course, it's obvious how those overlaps work in terms of the opposition against democratically elected leaders like Hugo Chavez, Nicolas Maduro, and Evo Morales, who really have the support of working class and impoverished people, and what the other side is, where the elites are. So there's definitely a big dimension to that. There's quite a bit of racism in the protests and the just regular opposition rhetoric in Venezuela as well. You know, I don't want to say it's across the board, but it exists, and it exists, I would think, would probably be a surprising extent to people that aren't really familiar with Venezuela and Venezuelan media. I mean, the newspapers will publish pretty explicitly racist cartoons on a regular basis and things like that. So this is the kind of thing that the U.S. doesn't even mention in the cables. It's not like they're saying, we're bothered that so-and-so is using this kind of racist rhetoric or that this newspaper published this very racist thing, but these are people that support our interests in Venezuela. I mean, it's just not really something that comes up. So that in itself is very disturbing. You're seeing the U.S. government deliberately overlook the level of racism that characterizes some aspects of the opposition in these countries.
And finally, the New York Times and other corporate publications have the same access or more access to the WikiLeaks cables as you do, but they're not doing this kind of study.
No, that's right. I mean, the things that we talk about in this new book from Verso called The WikiLeaks Files, which includes a number of chapters by other authors, experts on various regions of the world as well. This is information that in many cases the major media outlets such as The Guardian, New York Times, and others had first dibs on, because WikiLeaks originally, when the Cablegate cables were coming out, they did partnership with numerous media outlets around the world. So these were outlets that had the first opportunity to look at some of these cables before they were published in full by WikiLeaks. So in many cases, this is stuff that could have been broken by these major newspapers originally. But instead, really what a lot of the major press focused on in terms of the Latin America coverage and, you know, other countries as well, in terms of the cables, was what basically reinforces the State Department and U.S. government line regarding things. And it was essentially kind of a punching down in terms of what snarky things or demeaning things do the cables reveal about Haitian President René Préval or Argentine President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner or, you know, things like that. And it was really kind of reinforcing the State Department line. You even had the New York Times saying, well, essentially, the cables reaffirm the idea of the U.S. being a benevolent actor in the world. And, you know, if you take a deeper look, you'll see that that's not necessarily the case at all.
That was Dan Beaton of the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
There will soon be a new film on the aftermath of Katrina in New Orleans. Kimberly Rivers Roberts produced her first film, Trouble the Water, shortly after the 2005 catastrophe in her hometown. The film was nominated for an Oscar and won several awards at the Sundance Film Festival. Ms. Rivers Roberts is also known by her hip-hop artist name, Queen Cold Medina. Her new film looks at what has happened to New Orleans in the 10 years since Katrina. It's titled Fear No Gumbo.
Well, my first film, Trouble the Water, we're trying to get the story out of what happened before, during, and after Katrina with that film, using my story and my husband's story as a representation of what happened to many of the African-American community, and not just that community, just people on the Gulf Coast, period. So with that film, our goal was really to get that story out so people could know, because the news wasn't reporting it right. People wasn't telling it right. They just basically was speculating what was happening on the ground level during Katrina, at least for the first 5 days, which my film covered. But we was able to kind of contradict that and really get that story out and to prove that Katrina was the worst disaster that happened to African Americans since slavery, pretty much, in a mass, you know, in terms of a mass number of low-income or poor people, mostly black people that it happened to. So I think we accomplished that with the Trouble the Water documentary. We were able to get it out, get it funded, number one, get people seeing and get people understanding what happened. The film actually was a boundary-breaking. Like, people didn't even have a clue, but yet that film kind of brought everybody back to the table to discuss disaster recovery and to discuss what happened during Katrina. So I think that to some degree, well, to a great degree, that was accomplished with that first documentary. With the second film that we're trying to do, Fear No Gumbo, is the follow-up to Trouble the Water. We want folks to understand that the recovery isn't over even 10 years later, We've been shooting for 3.5 years on this documentary, documenting the recovery. And the goal for the film is to basically get people talking again. Let's discuss, to get people to engage in conversation about what happened after Katrina, not just seeing it hit, but know how was the recovery from African-American communities. Get folks to rethink how that looked, get them discussing that, change policies, and basically raise awareness about, you know, what happens in African-American communities or poor communities when disaster hits, when storms hit and their whole community is destroyed like New Orleans. New Orleans was 80% flooded, but the Lower Ninth Ward is still the only community on the Gulf Coast that has not recovered. Why they haven't recovered? Sentinel Gumbo highlights that. Hopefully this could be an educational piece to get people back to the table, get some positive changes, and definitely get the Lower Ninth Ward rebuilt. So that community deserves that.
And why'd you call the film Fear No Gumbo?
Well, gumbo is a mixture of everything. Like, you know, gumbo, you can make fish gumbo, shrimp gumbo, you can make meatless gumbo, vegan gumbo now. They tell me they got that out there now. So a gumbo is a mixture of things, and the documentary is just not one base thing. It's a mixture of different things that has happened during the recovery, and the fear is the dividing part. You know, so it's the fear that causes the racism. It's the fear that has divided the people. It's the fear of people not coming down to want to understand the Lower Ninth Ward. In some cases, it's the fear that has divided the people, period. It's the fear, I understand, they keep black people and white people both living in their bubble. So the key is don't fear the story. Understand it, embrace it, let's come together, and let's discuss it and take action.
Even the word recovery should be controversial. There's been no recovery for 100,000 people who weren't able to come back, and there's a whole new population there, post-Katrina population.
The fact that we've been discussing recovery is an issue. It should be have recovered, like past tense. It's been 10 years.
So that's that conversation that people are having after 10 years. Much of it seems to be saying that New Orleans is a much better place after Katrina than before. At least it sounds like that.
Well, I'm glad people are thinking that, because that's what Fear No Gumbo comes in there. And we're not telling people that New Orleans has recovered. We're showing them. You see the film, you saw the clip. What's your opinion about that? How that made you feel? How would you feel if that was your community? You know, and so on. So that's what Fear No Gumbo comes in there. I mean, yeah, people have their opinion. New Orleans has bounced back. But, you know, Fear No Gumbo shows something different, and we definitely trying to get folks engaged, discussing it, talking about it, and let's think about what that means for America, what that means for us here in the 21st century, you know?
And of course, putting that message out there does cost money. How are you going about raising it?
Well, with me having so much going on, we just started our Indiegogo campaign. It's been on probably about a month now, and we're trying to just raise awareness and get folks involved. I mean, get folks to donate those fives, those tens, those whatever they can donate to help it get funded. But anywhere it go, this film is going to get funded anywhere it go. You know, the Indiegogo is just an avenue that I took to kind of get my fans back engaged and know to get them involved with the follow-up film. And we're trying to get folks involved. I mean, we have a lot of great perks, a lot of great items folks can get if they give. So, yeah, it's really been promoting that. With the 10-year Katrina anniversary, this was a couple of weeks ago, I had a couple of screenings of Fear No Gumbo. We had like a 20-minute sneak preview of it, and folks really received it well, you know. So we're trying to really get some big donors involved, get some groups involved, you know, get some church groups involved. And that's the avenue that we're taking now to get folks involved with this.
You were speaking of your fans. You're also a rap artist known as Queen Cold Medina.
Yeah, Queen Cold Medina is my rap name. I did the music for Trouble the Water under the name Black Cold Medina. And it was during that album right there, which my song Trouble the Water was also Oscar nominated. And we also won quite a few musical awards with that particular song, which was the ending credit song for Trouble the Water, named Trouble the Water. I have a new album coming out called Fear No Gumbo. It's going to be named after the documentary. And we just taking an avenue again to start getting folks back engaged with the music and with the film and kind of make it one big great gumbo, I guess, right?
Have other members of the hip-hop community in New Orleans been a part of this project?
Not the Fear No Gumbo project at all. I mean, with the dwindling hip-hop scene here in New Orleans, you know, the way the city promotes the jazz, the bluegrass, all this zydeco and all this other genres of music, you know, it's kind of hard to really get the pop community involved because it's so small here. But yet, you know, you have some of the greatest artists from all over the world who are national stars, such as Lil Wayne, Cash Money Records, who don't even really perform here in New Orleans because of the hip-hop scene being so monopolized by the way the city promotes to the tourist industry. I've had issues of discrimination against the type of music that I perform here in New Orleans. So basically, the hip-hop scene here is just dying along with the wetlands, I like to say.
So hip-hop doesn't fit the theme park that New Orleans boosters want to make it?
Correct. And that's one of the issues that we're highlighting in Fear No Gumbo also.
And tell us how people can go about being of financial service to the new film.
Well, we're asking folks to go on to Fear No Gumbo. Just look up Fear No Gumbo anywhere you look it up. Indiegogo will be the right place to go. So go to Fear No Gumbo, Indiegogo. We're asking folks to donate any amount if they think the film is important and want to help us get the film out. Fear No Gumbo. Just look it up.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.